Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I'm your host, Pierce Redman. So today we have a very special guest. We have our friend Tom Secker, who is joining us from the grassy knolls of Northern England. And Tom is here to talk about his new book, Secret Spies and 7-7. Now, Tom really needs no introduction on this show, but for anyone that doesn't know, Tom is a writer, researcher, and a filmmaker. He is the webmaster of investigatingtheterror.com, as well as spyculture.com, where he hosts his excellent podcast series, Clandestime. He is the filmmaker behind 7-7, Seeds of Deconstruction, and 7-7, Crime and Prejudice. And he's also the author of Secret Spies and 7-7. Well, Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Pierce. It's good to be talking to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's been a little while, but I'm really excited to get into your book. So, Tom, for anyone that doesn't really know, what attracted you to the 7-7 case in the first place?
Well, I suppose the main thing is that this is something that happened in my own country. It happened in places that I'm familiar with. I know London. I've been to London many times. I've ridden on the tube. I've ridden on London buses. So when this event happened, by that point, I'd already been into 9/11 research for a couple of years. Well, yeah, probably a couple of years by that point. And so I was already familiar with the various theories and the various arguments that were bouncing around about 9/11, and completely on board with the idea that, you know, this official story, this official investigation is just nonsense. So when 7-7 happened, I suppose it happened in the context of me already doing this sort of research. And because it had happened in my country, I felt obliged, responsible in some way. I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but I had a compulsion to investigate this as well.
All right. Well, I even remember when 7-7 happened. I had a friend who was in London at the time, and I wasn't really into the truth movement or researching 9/11, but I do remember it, and it is sort of, you know, stuck in my brain as this, I don't know, the way they sort of contextualized it, where, you know, you have 9/11, then you had 7-7, so this was, you know, the war on terror is really happening, folks. This is real. Look, now it's even happening in England as well.
Yeah, sure, there was a big element of that, but let's not forget, in 2004, in March 2004, we had the attack on Madrid, which was far more deadly and far more destructive than 7-7 was. I mean, there you're talking about hundreds of people were killed. And
yeah, I know. I think maybe, hopefully we'll get into that a little bit later, but you mentioned that in your book as well, that, you know, Madrid happened. There were other things, but for, you know, I think a various set of reasons, 7-7 sort of became this big event that we all were sort of, you know, focused on and going into it, and especially this official story that we'll see. So I guess to start, maybe you could just briefly break down the sort of official conspiracy theory of 7-7, how it happened, and who these four alleged bombers were. And you know, give us the sort of the Home Office narrative, if you could.
Yeah, sure. Okay, 7-7. So July 7th, 2005, there are four explosions, officially four explosions, three on tube trains at about 10 to 9 in the morning. These are underground metro trains in London. There is also an explosion on a bus about an hour later. These are entirely and almost solely blamed on four young British Muslim men. They said that they were suicide bombers. They said that, you know, these guys are now dead. And we were sort of left to assume, oh, right, their bodies were found at the scenes and you have evidence that, you know, they were there blowing up these bombs. And the four guys, three are British-born men of Pakistani origin who grew up in Yorkshire. And, of course, I'm from Yorkshire. You know, these people grew up around the Leeds area. Leeds is really not that far from here. So I have a personal connection in that respect. I know Pakistani lads from Yorkshire. It's a sort of, you know, it's a community of people actually very familiar to me. You know, I used to work on a market stall next to one, next guy, a Pakistani guy who ran his market stall there. So, you know what I mean? These are the sorts of people who I have actually grown up around. The fourth guy was Jermaine Lindsay, who was born in Jamaica but grew up in Britain. He was the youngest of the four. I think he was only 18. He was 19. Haseeb Hussain was 18, the alleged bus bomber. Then you have Shehzad Tanweer, who was, 22, and Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who was supposedly the ringleader of this suicide bombing plot, who was 30. So, yeah, it was entirely blamed on four British Muslim suicide bombers. These were said to be homegrown, not part of any right. wider terrorist network, but that this had all happened, you know, they'd sort of self-radicalized and drawn each other into the plot.
Mm. And this, of course, is after we have all of these various media personalities coming on TV and saying, oh, this is the hallmark of Al-Qaeda. This is definitely Al-Qaeda. And then quickly the story changes to, no, there is no wider conspiracy. This is just four individuals. They are completely responsible. They radicalize themselves.
Yeah, sure. On the day itself, it was within about, 2 to 3 hours of these bombs going off. You have this line about that the attacks bear the hallmarks of Al-Qaeda. This first comes out through the BBC. Who else? and it then gets picked up by Jack Straw, who was the then Home Secretary. Hmm. Lots of other officials, lots of other media commentators. I highlighted this both in my book and in my first film, because it's just astonishing watching through this media coverage, and they're all basically working from the same script. To the extent that they're even all using this hallmarks of Al-Qaeda phrase. Yeah. And when you follow that phrase through since 7/7, it's become one of those sort of terror commentary memes
yes.
that you get a lot in the media. You know, they talked about that like that inkjet cartridge bomb
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
plots that never seemed to add up to very much.
Right,
and they were,
right.
you know, but for the first 48 hours, it was all hallmarks of Al-Qaeda, hallmarks
yeah.
of Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, yeah. They're under your bed. They're everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, they are. They are the new... Reds under the bed.
Yes, yes. Well, so I guess then, now that we have the sort of basic outline of what happened, maybe we can now get into some of the specifics in your book. The book is just excellent, and you really meticulously go through each subject. You go through the actual bomb sites, you go through the CCTV footage, you go through everything. But perhaps we can start with the actual bomb sites, because I that was, for me, what really kind of made me really question what was going on was the actual physical evidence at the bomb sites, because this doesn't really add up. And as you go on in your book in those early chapters, it is just inconsistency and contradiction after another between what the Metropolitan Police Service were saying, what the Home Office was saying, what the media, everybody. And there are just so many, you know, issues with all of this. So maybe we can start with, as I said, just the bomb sites on the tube trains. And particularly this idea that the bombs possibly could have even been underneath the train. And you talk a lot about all of the eyewitness accounts of metal shooting upwards. You talk about tiles in the trains going upwards. And then maybe we can get into the specifics about these diagrams that were presented to us by the Metropolitan Police Service and how they differ almost entirely from all of the eyewitness accounts.
Okay. I mean, the official story maintains that on the tube trains, three of the men got on separate tube trains at King's Cross on separate platforms, trains going in different directions, and that within a matter of minutes, they put rucksack bombs on the floor and blew themselves up and killed the people around them. So you would expect it to be a relatively straightforward thing to demonstrate. You'd have an epicenter of a bomb where you'd be able to cause one through a rucksack bomb, and that you'd be able to find these alleged bombers' bodies nearby in a state showing that they were, you know, at least next to the bombs when they went off. And this is sort of what the Home Office narrative says that they found, but they say it in even more sort of cryptic and ambiguous language. So there was always room for doubt. And I was always wondering about this one, because I always thought, you know, it's going to be difficult for skeptics of this story to refute that kind of evidence, if they actually have that kind of evidence. But we weren't presented with it for ages. What we were presented with was an awful lot of media coverage of eyewitnesses to these explosions, people within the carriages who survived, some who survived and were conscious essentially throughout. None of them pretty much saw these alleged bombers. There's a couple of pretty vague exceptions, but they don't really add up to much. They aren't reliable witnesses. So if you don't have those men at those scenes, either by eyewitness accounts or by CCTV, you got to wonder, were they there? Another predominant kind of theme in all these witness accounts that we get in the media reporting is, as you say, that these explosions happened underneath the trains or were somehow built into the floors of the carriages, and that people will describe, yeah, explosions kind of coming up through the floor, or at least other things that would be consistent with an explosion kind of underneath the train, such as the train derailing. So when you have all of this, and then you have the Home Office narrative kind of saying, well, we have these bodies of these guys, and they sort of indicate that they were close to the bombs when they went off, you're kind of wondering, well, okay, there's a lot of room for doubt in this. There's a lot of room for disbelieving this most fundamental thing about the story. Because, of course, if those men weren't there, they weren't suicide bombers. They didn't blow up those trains.
And where are they now, if they're even alive?
Well, I think it's safe to assume they're dead.
Yeah.
It's safe to assume that, you know, if they weren't there, which I think is borne out by pretty much all of the evidence that we do have and all of the problems with the official evidence, then, yeah, we can only assume they were somehow intercepted and bumped off. I don't know what. I don't know quite the mechanics of how they would do that, but there's a dozen different practical ways they could have done that. So, no, I don't think we'll ever see any we will ever see any of those men ever again. So, with all this media coverage and with all this sort of indication of explosions within the floors of the carriages or something like that, when we got to the inquests in 2010, 2011, these were judicial proceedings looking at the deaths of the people who died in these explosions, we got a whole bunch more witnesses, most of which had already been interviewed in the media and reaffirmed everything that they'd said. We also got a whole bunch of passenger-drawn diagrams of these bomb sites backing up all of these things that they'd said, and even indicating in some instances that there were multiple bombs, that there were multiple explosions in different parts of the floors of these carriages that caused multiple holes in them. So how could, say, four different holes caused in the Edgware Road tube carriage be caused by one small rucksack bomb being detonated by a suicide bomber? It couldn't be. Physically, you can't marry those two things. So that's, if you like, one of the most fundamental reasons to question this story.
Yeah, and you also write about that there were no postmortems on any of these victims. The woman who was tasked, Dr. Roberts, with reconstructing the bodies of the four alleged bombers, she had no experience with terrorism, no experience with bombings. And furthermore, there was no actual DNA evidence pointing the bombs to any of these bombers. So it really does paint this very sort of scary, disturbing picture of 7/7 that I think a lot of people aren't really used to. And just this whole notion that there could have been bombs underneath the trains. I mean, what does that say? You know, who is ultimately responsible then at that point?
Well, who would have the access?
Yes. Most, sort
of, you know, it's not going to be three Pakistani lads from Leeds, is it? So, I mean, I am joking, but, you know, I'm also deadly serious when I say yes. That. The idea that they could somehow have done this, or even Al-Qaeda, whatever you interpret Al-Qaeda to mean, could have done this. You know, it would have to be someone with access to these carriages beforehand. And I'm not convinced that Al-Qaeda has drastically infiltrated the London Underground. Network, you know what I mean? Whereas it's possible that MI5, well, of course it's possible that MI5 could have done this. They're exactly the sort of people who would have the access and would be able to infiltrate an organization and, you know, plant bombs and blame it on someone else. So they're the number one suspects, and they're the suspects that I chase throughout my films and throughout my book. I haven't got a case that I can take into a courtroom and say MI5 did it. Otherwise, I'd be in a courtroom trying to do this. But I did come up with, I think, a pretty credible, broad case, a broad-based evidence case without any sort of real smoking guns, that MI5 have got to be the suspects here. They've got to be the people that we most likely think did it. But yeah, the whole process by which the alleged bombers' bodies were found at the scenes and recovered and then examined and this determination made that they were in possession of the bombs, it's a complete joke. Because in one instance, we have, with the bus bombing, we basically have no information on how Haseeb Hussain's body was found at the scene, how it was identified as Haseeb Hussain, and the chain of evidence demonstrating, you know, it went from here to here to here, and therefore it must be this body. We just don't have that information. They've never told us it. In another instance, with Jermaine Lindsay on the Piccadilly line, he's on one of the trains. He's supposed to have blown it up himself and about 30 other people in the standing area of this train. Yet his body was found, they say, 20 feet away, 25 feet away. And there's a whole bunch of people who survived stood in between those two spots, none of which saw Jermaine Lindsay, none of which have any recollection of, you know, a body going flying past after this explosion or anything like that. So that's a pretty difficult problem to reconcile for the official story. In the other two instances, with Sadiq Khan at Edgware Road and with Shehzad Tanweer at Aldgate, they say that their bodies virtually disintegrated because of these small homemade, you know, explosives that they boiled up on their cooker. And, well, there's a huge problem there. Why did two bodies not disintegrate and two bodies almost completely disintegrate? I mean, you would expect equal-sized explosives of the same, exact same type to cause, broadly speaking, the same amount of damage. So that's a big problem for them. And in those two instances, when the... I'm trying to think of the person's name. A doctor called Morgan Costello was sent to these bomb sites, or some of the bomb sites, on the evening of the explosion, on the evening of 7-7 itself. And they were told to basically count up the bodies and make a pronouncement of death, a pronouncement of life extinct. And at both Edgware Road and Aldgate, they counted one less body than there should have been if Sadiq Shehzad Tanweer had been there. They didn't actually find those bodies until 2 days later in the case of Sadiq Khan and 2.5 days later in the case of Shehzad Tanweer. So what happened in those two and a half days? Did someone plant those bodies there? I mean, the fact that they couldn't find them on the evening of 7-7 yet managed to find them on the evening of July 9th suggests to me someone's got into these scenes in the meantime. And when you just generally, when you read through the police investigation, the accounts of their investigation of these bomb sites, you don't get an impression of a bunch of very competent, careful people. You get the impression that if someone wanted to sneak evidence onto these bomb sites, they could have done. And these police would then have just found it later and thought, oh, well, okay then. Didn't find it before. Write it down. So there's not only a massive problem for the official story here, there is also an identifiable way in which the evidence could have been manipulated if someone were so inclined.
Definitely. It just struck me, you know, just all of the different examples that you point out, this investigation is just so sloppy. And then seemingly, though, you know, it's they'll say one thing one day and then the next day it's something else, and the media and everyone just sort of agrees. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, they didn't find it before, but now they found it. And yes, maybe Mohammed Sadiq Khan's three different wallets are found at every single bomb site, but that's okay. We'll just sort of keep going along with this, and we'll go about our day as if this isn't bizarre at all.
Yeah. The mainstream media have completely failed to hold the police investigation to account. It's not like I expect the British police to do a proper investigation. I mean, Lord knows they struggle to do that with regular.
Right.
Let alone serious.
Right.
So their competence cannot be relied upon at all, or even expected. what you could hope for, and what does occasionally happen, is for the mainstream media to pick on a case and say, no, you've got this massively wrong. Your case doesn't add up. You're chasing the wrong people here. And sometimes this does happen in this country, but pretty much never with terrorism cases. And obviously it didn't happen with 7-7. And that's all the more reason why I got involved in this, is because I could just see that the police investigation was at best an incompetent disgrace, but that the mainstream media had no real interest in following this up. And the most basic questions that occur to me, at that point, a completely kind of amateur investigator, you know, they must have occurred to these journalists, and yet they never seemed to ask the question. So it was all the more important for me to sort of, you know, try and fill in that space as best I could.
Mm. No, certainly. And maybe now we could kind of move into another major part of your book itself, which is this notion of a wider conspiracy, which we've sort of been touching upon here. But we have the only three witnesses that are alleged to have seen these four people. We've got, I think, Sylvia Waugh, Sue Clark, and a man named Joseph Martakia. They all managed to see these men, but with multiple other people. Somewhere between 5 and 6. So again, this notion that there is a, you know, who were these other men? How have they never been investigated or, you know, looked for or anything like that? And then, of course, we move into the CCTV footage, which, in my opinion, at least as I was reading the book, just stinks of a wider conspiracy. And particularly this Jaguar car that is viewed on the morning of 7-7. And maybe we could get into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, on the morning of 7-7, according to the official story, the three guys up in Leeds go to the bomb factory where they built these bombs. They pick up their sort of final bomb-making equipment, load it into a car, drive down the M1 motorway to Luton. Meanwhile, the fourth guy, Jermaine Lindsay, has driven across from where he lives to Luton. So they meet up in Luton Station car park and then catch a train to London. So you have witnesses at each of these three points, key points of the journey. You have someone up in Leeds, you have someone in the car park in Luton Station, and you have someone at King's Cross where they eventually get to when they split up and catch their different vehicles that they supposedly bomb. The witness up in Leeds is an old lady called Sylvia Waugh, who, shall we say, harbours certain prejudices.
That was something that it seemed all of these people that saw them. There was another character on the bus who
yeah, Richard Jones.
Yeah, who had also kind of referred to one of them as sort of a racial slur, and that was a weird little thing. I don't know what that means, if it means anything, but it was funny that they all seemed to have these views.
Well, I suppose at that point we'd had a good 3.5 years. Well, a lot longer in reality, but a good 3.5-4 years of mainstream propaganda telling us, you know, watch out for the bloody Muslims,
right,
over and over and over again. Yes. And so that's surprising.
Yes.
But yes, yeah, so this old lady leaves, and she supposedly wakes up early in the morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, looks out of her window and sees these guys loading their backpacks and their bomb-making equipment into the car. But the problem is, she doesn't only see three people. She says she sees as many as 6 or 7 people, including Jermaine Lindsay, who isn't supposed to be there at that point. She claims he was there. And she says that at least one person got into a different car and drove off in a different direction. So these people have never been traced. One of the most sort of fundamental things. If they were actually there getting those bombs out of that bomb factory at that time, then who the person in that other car is massively important. It's a, you know, must-know piece of information for the investigation. And yet, this was barely reported by the media in the first place, and then completely forgotten in the police investigation, it seems. It's not mentioned by the Home Office. It comes out in the inquests, you know, 5-6 years later, but again, the media doesn't follow up on it. So that's a question I'd like the answer to, frankly. Then, when they meet up in Luton Station car park, you have this witness called Sue Clark. She also describes not just four people, but as many as 5 or 6 people meeting up in Luton Station car park in these two cars. Now, there should only be four, the four alleged bombers. The CCTV footage of that scene you can see Sue Clark, or at least a woman, doing the things that Sue Clark described doing. But you can't see close enough to see whether there's an additional person or two people by these cars, because it's fuzzy CCTV footage at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. Then by the time they get to King's Cross, again, there should only be four, they get witnessed by this guy, Joseph Martocchia, who says he's reported in the Home Office narrative, or obliquely used in the Home Office narrative, because the Home Office report says that the men were seen hugging shortly before split up and got on these vehicles and blew themselves up, and that they appeared euphoric, you know, trying to lend this notion. You know, they believed themselves to be martyrs. They were religious fanatics, whatever. But the problem is, Joseph Martocchia saw a group that were entirely Asian, so no black guy, no Jermaine Lindsay. And he describes as many as, again, six or seven. And he thought that they were a cricket team, that was his impression, that they were sort of stood there in sports gear and that maybe they were off to play cricket or something. And so you've got to take, that's what Joseph Martocchia said. And the way that the Home Office reported it is that there were only four men, that included Jermaine Lindsay, and that they were behaving euphoric because they were suicide bombers. That's not substantiated by pretty much anything that Joseph Martocchia has ever said. Yet he must be the source of that information, because he's the only guy in history who's ever spoken about this hug and this, you know, seeing them at King's Cross together. So that's a complete deception on the part of the Home Office. That's a rank manipulation of what this person has said. And so at every point in this journey that they probably did take, there's supposedly extra people. Well, who are these extra people? You know, we could speculate. They could be terrorist masterminds. They could be MI5 handlers. They could be any number of things. But who they are is absolutely vital to any serious investigation. And the police just weren't interested. Or if they were interested, they just got nowhere in finding these people. So, again, you've got to wonder, did they even care? Or were they just looking at these four men and saying, you know, blinkers on, we're not looking anywhere else?
That's the whole, every time that something happens, it's either got to be a lone wolf or it's got to be a very small group of people who had no access or, you know, no correspondence with anyone outside of this very small group. It's always just got to be, you know, very, very small, very compact, and let's not really go into anything else.
The one exception I'd say to that is 9/11.
They
alleged
yes.
that was carried out yes. by some sort of gigantic paramilitary yes. Islamic organization that no one seems to have actually been able to find.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, it's extremely difficult to find a 6 foot tall Saudi with dialysis in a cave. But going back to the CCTV footage, just briefly, you mention a part in your book that I found to be perhaps one of the most fascinating aspects of this case that has been completely ignored. And you focus on the CCTV footage, I believe it's from Luton, and you talk about the dry run, the supposed dry run that these four individuals took on June 28th. And it shows this mysterious Jaguar car that is in the parking lot. And I think it's during the dry run, where of course they go to none of the sites that were hit, and it flashes its lights. And then, we have the CCTV footage of the day of 7/7, and this same exact Jaguar is there. So maybe you could just briefly kind of talk about that, because I found this to be a really interesting aspect that seemingly no one in the 7/7 truth movement or anything like that seems to really focus on very much.
Well, what happened was 9 days before 7/7, three of the men... So the three, not including Haseeb Hussain, took a trip to London that in some way was replicated in their trip to London on the morning of 7/7 itself. But only three of them went. They didn't go to any of the places, any of the tube stations, or catch any buses in London or anything like that that would enable this to be some kind of surveillance operation for the real attack. Yet that is how the mainstream media has almost exclusively portrayed this earlier trip. And when we got the CCTV from this earlier trip on the 28th of June. This was released at the inquests, and researchers at the July 7th Truth Campaign, they were the ones who first spotted this. They noticed that this same car can be seen parked in basically the same place. I say the same car, a car that looks absolutely identical right. on both bits of footage, is parked in the same place in Luton Station car park at the same time that these men were there on the two different days. Now, these are different times of day. I think on June 28th, they were there about an hour and a half later. So the idea that this car was just there every day because it was dropping someone off or picking someone up doesn't, you know, I don't buy that, because for one thing, it's there at two different times, and for another, it's parked well away from the station. So if it was just there to drop someone off or pick someone up, it'd be, you know, parked outside the entrance. So you got to wonder, why is it there? And when I was looking on Google Street View, I was having a wander around Luton Station car park on Google Street View, I noticed that this patch in, I think it's the southwest corner of the car park, where this Jaguar is parked in both on both days in both bits of footage, is kind of raised up. It slopes up towards there, and from that point, it's the ideal kind of surveillance position for watching the entrance to the station, the car park across the road, and the rest of the car park that the car is parked in. When you look at the footage, you can see from that point, you can see the whole of the front of the station. So it's an ideal spotting position, that much is clear. On the morning of 7-7 itself, if you take the different bits of footage that have been released at different times, and I have copies of all of this and I've uploaded them on my YouTube, so you can go and have a look at this for yourself if you want, you can see that Jermaine Lindsay moves his car at about, I think it's 6:47 in the morning. He's been there for a while, waiting in this car park outside the station. He moves his car. Then the camera cuts out for a bit, and when it comes back, the Jaguar has appeared. It has entered the car park in the minute or so that the footage has been cut out for. Then the other guys turn up, the guys coming down from Leeds. As they enter this car park, as they drive into it, the Jaguar flashes its lights, switches the engine on, swings around, and starts moving. And then the footage cuts out again. So we can't see whether the Jaguar has driven off or parked somewhere else or what it has done. And the way that the footage has been released in two different batches, it's slightly different in the two different batches, which again obscures the movement of this mystery car. Furthermore, these two cameras at either end of the car park that is recording all of this, they were moved. They were repositioned between the 28th, the footage that you can see from the dry run, the so-called dry run, and on the morning of 7-7. In those 9 days, someone moved and repositioned these cameras. And again, they've been repositioned in such a way as to obscure the movements of this mystery Jaguar. So all of this suggests to me, this car is very significant. There is something important going on with this. Sadly, it's a lead that goes nowhere, because we can't get the license plate from the footage. We can't, to be honest, I've filed Freedom of Information requests trying to get the bits of missing footage or find out what happened to them. I've always sort of been jerked around and, you know, ultimately had my request denied. And they sidelined me for about 6 months because of the Olympics. We had the Olympics in so I'm waiting around for them to respond to this FOIA request, and I get this email saying, oh right, well, the entire FOIA office seems to have been shut down because of the additional security needed.
God.
You're taking a mick, aren't you? I knew when I was filing these FOIA requests, it's extremely unlikely being useful, but I kind of did it because I felt, you know, I had to do it if anything, demonstrate that they are continuing to cover this up. And then they sort of add another 6 months onto the time it takes them to respond by using the Olympics as an excuse. I mean, it's complete
sad excuse to use.
Yeah.
What really struck me was just that, if let's just say that this was just four individuals who murdered one person. Now, if this was just a regular police case picked up by the police in Luton, you would think that this Jaguar would really strike them as something odd. And, you know, you can picture any number of crime drama TV shows where they would have this and everyone would, you know, be sitting at home wondering, oh, what's in the car? But yet it seems that with a mass murder with, you know, 50 plus people killed. No, it's okay. We don't really need to look into this. It's so odd the way that these big sort of terrorist events sort of leave the police just, you know, they would never get away with this if this was just one person's murder. You know, this would be a huge deal. But yet with this huge amount of people dead, they're able to brush all of these little points under the rug.
You're right. It would be, in some ways, much harder to cover up an ordinary murder, or it seems to be. So, yeah, the question should be, why haven't the police ever spoken about this Jaguar? Surely they must have spotted this in the footage. And if they haven't, then, you know, Jesus.
Right, yes, I know. What are they doing?
How thick are these people?
Right.
But, by contrast, when you actually look at the timeline of when they say they recovered this CCTV from Luton Station, it seems that they were there actually a day earlier than they should have been, or at least a day earlier than they should have been. They seem to have sort of remarkable powers of premonition when it came to getting to Luton Station and finding this CCTV, because according to the story that they've told, they were actually there either the same day that they identified the four men on CCTV in London. If you think they're going backwards in time, so they identify them in London and then they have to go back earlier in the day to identify them earlier in their journey. And so how did they get from finding four men on one little bit of footage from King's Cross, four men wandering along with backpacks, how did they get from that to Luton Station, which is, you know, 100 miles away? It's not 100 miles away, but it's dozens of miles away. Why did they pick that particular station only hours later and turn up there demanding to see the CCTV footage? How did they figure that one out? And like I say, depending on which testimony and which reports you read, they may have actually been there the day before they'd even found these guys on the London footage. So, you know, it's a ridiculous story. It really is. And so the notion that they couldn't have spotted this Jaguar and couldn't have twigged the relevance of it is absurd. And the only reason for them not to have ever mentioned this and not to have followed up this lead and not to have, you know, sort of blanked, avoided, you know, drawing anyone's attention to it is because someone's told them to. They must have spotted it, so someone must have said, no, don't look at that car, don't try and sort of figure out who's in that car, because otherwise that would just be the most basic instinct that a police person should have. No,
one would hope so. an incompetent one
should at least wonder, well, who's in this car that seems to be there at the same time as that these guys are there.
I think the man on the street would think to look at that. I mean, it just seems so obvious. Well, we could probably talk all day about the CCTV footage, and there are a lot more things that you discuss in your book, and I don't want to give those all away, because people really should go out and buy the book and read through it and really take the time to absorb it, because there's so much there. But I think maybe now we could move on to one of the cruxes of the whole official 7-7 conspiracy theory, and that is this notion of intelligence failures, which is another one of these buzzwords that the talking heads in media and the government love to just throw out. And they always say, oh, this was an intelligence failure. You know, if only this group had shared information, and if we had done this, and then maybe, you know, we would have been able to avert this. And you spend a lot of time talking about the intelligence failures, and you present a very clear case that these are not in. Maybe this is the real intelligence failure: is that it presented us with this narrative that essentially all of the failures went back and convinced people, oh, they were the bombers. You know, all of the so-called failures sort of set these four men up as, oh yes, they were suicide bombers. And you focus on three or four major people, and perhaps first we could just briefly just touch on McDade and the Iqra Bookshop, which seems to be the hotbed of radical Islam in England, is this bookshop and the greater area. I forget where it is right now, but you describe it as being portrayed, at least in the media, as, you know, some sort of Al-Qaeda training ground in England.
Well, sure. I mean, just to clarify what you're saying, my argument is that after 7/7, MI5's initial version was, we don't know these guys, we never knew these guys, we didn't know anything about them. They called them clean skins, or at least this term, clean skins, was being circulated in the mainstream media. That basically means we knew nothing about them. Then, pretty soon, they say, okay, they did sort of turn up on the fringes of an investigation that we were running, but we didn't really have any information on them of any significance. Then, another couple of years later, there's a trial of various men that MI5 had been investigating before 7/7. And during the course of this trial, it emerges actually MI5 had quite a lot of information on these guys, because some of the alleged bombers met up with some of these guys that were then prosecuted a couple of years after 7/7. So we got another report, and that outlined a timeline of what MI5 knew and when they knew it. And this was much more extensive than their earlier story of, oh, they just sort of turned up on the fringe of the investigation. Then we got the inquests. At that point, a whole load of documentation from these various pre-7/7 investigations became available. And when I went through it in detail and compared the timeline that we got in the 2009 report, the documentation that MI5 had made available, and the testimony of the MI5 witness at the inquests, I found that timeline that they gave us earlier is completely shredded. It's nonsense. It's a fiction. And yet, there was no real questioning of the MI5 witness on this issue, or every time it came up, it was just a, oh, well, I don't know, I wasn't actually running these operations, so I can't answer in that degree of detail. That was pretty much their excuse for about several days of testimony that, you know, they're facing people who died supposedly at the hands of these suicide bombers asking these questions, and they're sort of saying, I wasn't part of that investigation, so I can't tell you. Well, right. What use are you then? Why are you even on the witness stand? You clearly know nothing. And so the whole dynamic that has been set up by this drib-drab process over a number of years is that every time someone turns around to MI5 and says, what did you know about these guys before 7/7? MI5 replies by saying, oh, well, we knew this and that and that. And that all conveniently makes them look like Islamic terrorists. Mm. Because, oh, they were involved in this radical bookshop. Oh, they made these trips to Pakistan. Oh, they were involved with these people who later became convicted terrorists. And so all of this stuff has conveniently generated a backstory for these men that has convinced the public, oh, they were Islamic suicide bombers, they were fanatics. Whereas, because I've never bought the notion of these as failures, per se, I don't buy into that. I was looking at, why did these men get involved in the different activities? Why were they involved in a radical bookshop? Why did they go to Pakistan? Why were they talking to these guys who later ended up being convicted of terrorism? Mm. And when I looked into that in as much detail as I could, I found this disturbing pattern whereby every time these men did something that would later be used to incriminate them, they did it through contact with one of three or four men, one of which is definitely a spook, two of which are probable spooks, and the other one I'm just not very sure about. So the first one is Martin McDade, like you say, from about 2001 to 2004, these men, or at least Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer, to a lesser extent Haseeb Hussain, were involved in this Iqra bookshop in Leeds, in an area called Beeston, which is sort of near Leeds. This was an Islamic bookshop. They sold Islamic literature there. They also arranged training camps, so-called training camps, in the Lake District, which also not very far from here. The problem is, these training camps weren't exactly militant training camps. they kind of did military style exercise drills a bit, you know, running up and down hills with backpacks or whatever. But there was no weapons, there was no explosives, there was no combat training, there was no nothing of that sort. So from a terrorist point of view, these were, you know, you might as well just go to the gym or go for a run or something for all the training that you can get in how to be a terrorist. But these camps were run by this guy called Martin McDade, who is a white Scottish so-called convert to Islam, who used to serve in the Special Boat Squadron, which is like the SAS, but the Navy equivalent. So he supposedly was an elite British Special Forces soldier who sometime in the 1990s became a Muslim and then started running this radical bookshop and getting young men involved in these camping trips to the Lake District. These trips and this bookshop were being monitored by the security services in quite a lot of detail. And if you look in the book and you look at the documentation that I've compiled, you'll see at almost every point MI5 clearly knew more than they're letting on that they knew. So they not only knew what we have laid out for us that they've admitted to, there's also a whole bunch of other stuff that they clearly also knew that they're saying, no, we didn't. So, you know, and this is the same pattern that you get with the other things, with the trips to Pakistan, mm-hmm. where they go to a terrorism training camp that is actually a terrorism training camp, where they did actually, you know, do some stuff based in, you know, building little explosives and blowing up some rocks and startling some goats and things. But the problem is this camp is being run by Mohammed Janaid Babar, who, according to everyone, pretty much, including a senior guy in the FBI, everything that everyone has ever said about him indicates that he was a spy, that he was a deep cover agent working for at least US intelligence and probably British intelligence as well, or was kind of being shared between agencies, perhaps, because so many of the people who get involved with him were British. And pretty much everyone who passes through Janaid Babar's camp in the 3 years that he was running it, pretty much all of them end up being convicted terrorists.
Except for him, right?
Except for him. Oh, yeah. No. He pled guilty to international terrorism. He pled guilty to pretty much everything. He pled guilty to raising money and giving equipment to Al-Qaeda. He pleaded guilty to running a terrorism training camp. He pleaded guilty to traveling all over the world liaising with terrorists. And he ended up getting about 4.5 years in prison. Whereas the average sentence for one of the people who passed through his terrorism training camp is about 15 to 20 years. So the only other people who had anything to do with this terrorism training camp who haven't ended up as convicted terrorists ended up as alleged suicide bombers and are now dead. So to me, this just screams some kind of black operation. Mm. And I mean, I have a document collection on Janaid Babar that you can get free on my Investigating the Terror website, which that was everything I had at the time. Since then, I found even more evidence suggesting that this guy's timeline, this guy's biography, this guy's background, this guy's behavior, this guy's the way he instantly turned as soon as he returned to the US, he instantly turned and became an FBI cooperator. Everything about his story screams he was a spy, he was a deep cover of black operative, black agent of some kind. So there is another guy, Mohammed Qayyum Khan, who's known as Q, like the character in the James Bond films.
I love that reference that you make there with the facilitator and Q. And
yeah, he was supposedly an Al-Qaeda facilitator.
Yeah.
Now, like McDade, he was never arrested. Everyone he liaised with was arrested or ended up being blamed as suicide bombers, but he himself was never arrested. He himself was never, unlike Babar actually, neither McDade nor Q have ever been on trial. They've never even been called as a witness. Mm. This is the thing. If these people are known to the security services, if they are supposedly high ranking and central to these plots, whatever these plots really are, and yet they've not been arrested, why aren't they being used as a cooperating prosecution witness?
Mm.
Why aren't they even being used as a witness for the defense? Someone would want that person on trial to say something. So the only reason that doesn't happen is because of state secrecy. It's not admitted that that's the reason why this hasn't happened, but it's the obvious conclusion we have to come to, because there's just too much at stake. Too many people would want them on trial for them to not turn up. So, and when you look at previous examples like the Ali Mohammed case, same sort of thing. Why is it that Ali Mohammed, all of his trainees end up on trial throughout the 1990s, yet no one manages to get him on trial as a witness in these cases?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same sort of pattern. It's just not what you would expect if this was a normal case, if these people were genuinely guilty and this was a normal prosecution, normal trial. The only reason why you get this weird disappearing act for certain key figures in these plots is because they're spooks, or at least protected assets of some sort.
Mm. And even some of the bombers, you talk, I think it was Sadiq Khan even asks one of a different person who's also involved in this whole Operation Crevice is the name of this operation where MI5 was monitoring them. And he even asks, who are you? Are you really a terrorist? So even these alleged bombers were questioning, who are these guys that we're meeting with and that are sending us to Pakistan and to these training camps? I found that really, funny and horrifying, and that you know, even they were wondering, can I trust this person? Is he really who he says he is?
Yeah, well, there's several different ways of interpreting that. That question is asked by Sadiq Khan of a guy called Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam was supposedly the leader of the Islamic terrorist plot that was being investigated in this big operation by MI5 called Operation Crevice. Well, MI5 and Special Branch. And they were monitoring these guys for like a year, more than a year. And all of these people are the network that was being facilitated by this guy Q. Q never went on trial. All of the others in this went on trial. At some point, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, probably through his contact with Q, because we can trace his contact with Q back much, much earlier than his contact with Omar Khayyam, it's probably Q that puts Khan in contact with Khayyam. And he meets up with him on several occasions in early 2004. Well, I think late 2003, early 2004. So a year and a half before 7/7. MI5 monitor these meetings. They even follow Khan in his car back up the motorways, hundreds of miles to Leeds, follow him home, get the license plate of the car, get the addresses that he stops at. They chase all of this stuff up, and yet somehow they claim, oh no, we didn't know anything about this guy. So in one of these meetings with Khayyam that is being monitored by MI5 to the extent that they actually bugged the conversation, Khan asks him, so are you really a terrorist? And Khayyam responds that he's not a terrorist, but that they're working through him. That's the phrase he uses, that they're working through us. Well, who are working through you? And are they terrorists per se, or are they, you know,
something else?
Yeah. And there's several different ways potentially to interpret this. You're right. One is that Khan is worried, who is this guy? Who is this guy that I've sort of been told to meet up with and who's kind of talking in relatively vague terms about jihad and so on and so forth, and talking about going out to Pakistan and all the rest of it. That's one way of looking at it. Another is that Khan was an informant for the security services, that he was actually a spy as part of Operation Crevice, that they'd recruited him to spy on Omar Khayyam. And so he's there trying in a rather ham-fisted way to get him to talk, asking a really, you know, blunt question like, are you really a terrorist? I mean, it's an odd question. Mm. It's not the sort of question that you would expect would ever come up in conversation. So whatever way you look at it, you are left with this... Yeah, you're wondering, is Omar Khayyam really a terrorist? I mean, this guy's serving a 30-year prison sentence for supposedly planning a fertilizer bomb attack in Britain. But if he's surrounded by people who are either spooks or probable spooks, is he really a terrorist? And thus, is Sadiq Khan really a terrorist? Was he really a suicide bomber? And if he wasn't, what is he?
Yeah, I mean that is the you know, $500 question. There is who are these four men, and if MI5 had so much information about them. They have phone calls of them talking and meeting and going to Pakistan, and yet they let them go. I mean, this is a difficult question, but I mean, what does that ultimately say about MI5 and also about 7-7? I mean, how could they let these people go? You know, you ultimately go to this sort of a mindset where they let 7-7 happen. And I don't know if that's totally accurate, but, you know, you are left with very few sort of avenues to go down.
Well, it depends on whether or not you buy into the notion that these men were responsible for 7-7. Mm. If you do, if you think, despite all the problems with the official story, that, okay, these men still were there and were suicide bombers, then, yeah, you're left with the conclusion that MI5 let it happen. They had too much information on them. They had addresses. They had mobile phone numbers. They had cars linked to them. They had photographs of them. They had information going back to before 9/11. So you have information going back 4.5 years before 7/7 that they first encounter these guys. So how did they not manage to put this together? They're an intelligence service, for heaven's sake. They're one of the world's oldest intelligence services. They should be able to, you know, have a database where they can look up the name Sadiq Khan and notice that it's turned up in other investigations. And yet, the story that we're given as to, you know, why it was that they were unable to do this is, you know, a complete load of it's a steaming load of crap.
Yeah.
So like I say, if you think they were responsible, you're left with the question, did MI5 let it happen? And the answer, it seems so. If they didn't do it, if they weren't responsible for 7-7, then what is this thing that we're looking at that seems to be MI5 letting them go? Is it actually that some of them, at least Sadiq Khan, I would say is the most likely one, was working for the security services? And were they letting him go because they needed to keep him in play because they were ultimately going to double-cross him and claim that he was a suicide bomber? It's an ugly question, but like I say, there is a pattern in these so-called failures that very much indicates that. A pattern that I've laid out and documented in more detail than I think anyone else has ever managed to do. In fact, has ever managed to do with almost any terrorism case. So I think there's a lot of evidence there. I think there is an extremely incriminating pattern that indicates that's exactly what MI5 were doing, that they were in some way running Khan as an informant or something, and that they double-crossed him, that he'd never actually carried out 7-7, but MI5 set him up to make it look like he did.
Which, of course, then begs the question of why did MI5 want 7-7 to even take place? But maybe we can get into that a little bit later. We've been talking now for about an hour, so maybe we'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss the case a little bit further. We'll get into all of the predictive programming that went into this. But before we take the break, Tom, would you like to just tell everybody where they can find your book, which everyone should go out and get a copy of? It is just so fantastic, and it's filled with so much, and Tom's writing style is just absolutely wonderful, everything you write.
Thank you, Pierce.
No, you beautifully write these things. I mean, and it's just wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I did work very hard on this book. But yeah, if you want the ebook version, you can get it. It's available in all the usual ebook stores, Amazon, iBooks, whatever. If you want the paperback, you can get it exclusively through my website, investigatingtheterror.com. There is an advert on the homepage that you'll just see if you click onto the site. That's also on the homepage of spyculture.com. If you just click on that, you get to the page where you can order the book, or you can download some of the documents from it, or you can download the first chapter if you want to have a look at the first chapter and get a feel for what this book is all about. So yeah, investigatingtheterror.com.
All right, excellent. So yeah, like I said, Tom, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll go into this in some more detail.
Sure.
Okay, everybody, so that was part one of me and Tom Secker's discussion of his new book, Secret Spies and 7-7. If you enjoyed this podcast, then I would suggest that you go to my website, which is porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. There you can find all of my other podcasts, you can find articles that I write, videos that I post, anything like that. And of course, you can subscribe through the RSS feed or through email. I'm also on Twitter, at Porkins Policy, and you can also find me on YouTube by just simply searching Porkins Policy Radio. And if you do like the work that I'm doing, I would really appreciate it if you just spread it around, send it to someone, post it on your website, or whatever, really like that. But every little bit helps in spreading this message. Thanks again.